It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor here at Best Ideas 2018, who is based in both Toronto and Hong Kong and currently joining us in this conversation from Toronto. Clement Lowe is the investment manager at Lion Rock Partners and brings more than 8 years of professional experience to the summit. As we're going to hear more in a moment, Lion Rock Partners invests across publicly traded equities, bonds, and options with a focus on absolute return, driven by a portfolio strategy that blends a long-term investment horizon for core holdings together with opportunistic shorts and embraces worldwide diversification. Prior to founding Lion Rock Partners, Clement was a team member at the Anson Group of Funds based in Toronto. On behalf of the MOI Global community, a very warm welcome. Please proceed.
Thank you so much, Shai, for the kind introduction. It's been really a pleasure for me to see how Manual of Ideas has evolved into a truly global network of value investors. And in that spirit, I would like to introduce a market that I think should be on the radar screen of the global investor. And that market is Vietnam. So we can start with the standard disclaimer. This presentation is for discussion purposes only and not an investment recommendation. So please do your own work and investment research. So Lion Rock Partners is a private family fund with a flexible mandate to invest in any assets around the world. And our investment time horizon is hopefully will span generations. Having worked on the buy side in both a large institutional setting and also in a smaller hedge fund, I realized a lot of the constraints on performance comes from the way the industry is structured. For example, a lot of asset managers are incentivized to collect assets and to not underperform peers. And as we all know, the AUM pays the rent. And a lot of times we're at the mercy of redemption pressure, and we have to be forced to sell at exactly the wrong times. There is quarterly and yearly performance benchmarks to meet. There are constraints placed on you on the asset class that you can invest in and the strategies that you can take. A lot of funds can go short. They won't be able to hold a large amount of cash for a long time without alienating a lot of investors. They may not be able to buy options, invest in small caps, or invest in non-mainstream markets. And the investment decision-making process itself, I find, can be a hindrance to finding absolute performance and the use of committees, VAR, and other ways of trying to quantify risks. Even brokers trying to dictate what's on your radar screen and how you spend your time. For example, in Canada, you know, we used to look at mining stocks all the time, and now it seems to be marijuana stocks. So, you know, I don't think this is the best way to go about building an investment firm. So when I was tasked with investing my own family wealth, which was mainly held in Hong Kong real estate, and to diversify and grow it, I decided to start from scratch and design a process that can obtain the best absolute return over a generational time horizon. So when it comes down to my investment philosophy, I really like to start from first principles. So value investing really underlies everything we do. We invest in companies as part owners of the business. And that means that we want to be able to estimate an intrinsic value for our investments based upon a deep understanding of the industry and the business model, and compare that with the price, which could be very often influenced by market psychology. The companies that we like to own have competitive advantages that allow them to earn an above return on capital, which result in a growing cash flow stream for the owner. For me, another huge inspiration was the book Venture Capitalist by Jim Rogers. So in the book, Jim Rogers chronicles a 3-year car journey around the world. And it really shows how much you can learn about the world and different investment opportunities simply through talking to local people and observing what's going on in other parts of the world. And you find that economics and business principles are universal, because I think humans all respond to the same incentives and have very similar needs despite cultural differences. And most investors unconsciously look for their investments within their home markets. I mean, think about how you screen for investments. A lot of times we immediately will say, okay, we'll only look at North American stocks above a certain market cap value. So availability bias is a huge factor in our investment process. And a lot of times we simply don't know what's out there. So being open to investing in different geographies opens up many different opportunities. And making travel and learning about different countries a core part of my investment process really opened up my investment universe. So my preferred approach is to first identify areas where there is a large potential for mispricing. So generally, why does mispricing occur? So the first reason is that there's informational asymmetry. So in developed markets, I find that there is very little edge that can come from getting information ahead of everybody else outside of trading. And you know, in fact, a lot of algorithms right now trade based on the content of company press releases and filings that go out before any human can read them. But in emerging and frontier countries, there are often a lot of under-the-radar companies that people simply don't know exist or that don't screen well. And it's hard to obtain information due to language barriers. So sometimes you're able to get a lot of useful information through simply talking to company management and general scuttlebutt, talking to people on the ground, asking them what they know about the company. And even it's even better if there's little or no analyst coverage of the company. So the second edge you can get on the market is analytical edge. And for me, I think it's hard to find an analytical edge in, say, blue chip US stocks, where there are dozens of analysts covering the company and pretty much every single angle has been looked at a dozen times. So my assumption when I look at, say, a widely held US stock is that I'm competing against institutional investors with teams of analysts, all supported by mountains of sell side reports and access to management. And generally, that's not who I want on the other side of the trade. So there are markets where the marginal investor, it's still the retail mom and pop person who trades on news and momentum. And I think a market like Vietnam or China A shares market are two examples that tend to be a little more inefficient in this aspect. And I would rather trade against grandma, you know, who looks at charts and buys a stock because she likes the name, over competing against institutional investors any day. And the third edge, as a value investor, I think, and actually I think this is the main edge that I have, is on the behavior side. I mean, can we treat the gyrations of Mr. Market with equanimity? Are we able to sit on an investment and just let compound and take care of itself? So I like to find myself in situations where I can maximize my edges and apply the value investing process. So why is Vietnam an attractive place for me right now? Well, I grew up in Hong Kong during the 1980s and witnessed firsthand the rise of the tiger economies. It was also referred to as the Asian miracle. So over a span of around 40 years, there was a sustained rapid growth in GDP. And these economies went from agri and farming to export oriented to service and consumption oriented. And over that time, there was massive improvements in the quality of life and wealth creation. If we look at what happened in the stock market in Hong Kong, say from the 80s to now, that's an example of how much wealth that can be created during that period. And there was a few common characteristics with the tiger economies at that time. They were export-oriented, industrial estates, and encouragement of foreign investment to bring in foreign expertise, so that the locals know how to enter into the global economy. There was heavy investment in infrastructure and education. A lot of these economies have like a Confucian philosophical background, which value group cooperation and sacrifice and the postponement of consumption in favor of investment. There was a liberalization of the economy as well within a very stable macroeconomic environment. And that's the economic, that's the dynamics that I see playing out in Vietnam right now. So flying into Ho Chi Minh City today, for me, feels a lot like heading into Shenzhen in the 1990s from Hong Kong. There's construction everywhere. And every time you go into the country, you know, even if it's after just a few months, you notice big changes. New buildings go up, new coffee shops spring up everywhere. They're much better than Starbucks, by the way. And you see, you know, so much new entrepreneurial activity happening. And Vietnam is a lot like China about a decade ago. And in terms of where the GDP per capita is, they are catching up very quickly. So the GDP growth in Vietnam right now is expected to be over 6% this year. And there has been a lot of banking reforms that's been completed to resolve a lot of the old non-performing loan problems in the banking system to give more access to credit for consumers and small businesses. The minimum hourly wage in Vietnam right now is 30 cents US compared to $1.19 in China and 73 cents in the Philippines. So there's a huge cost advantage in doing business and manufacturing work in Vietnam. And that's evidenced by very strong foreign investment inflows. The demographics also are stark difference to that of Europe, US, and Japan. The median age in Vietnam right now is 30, compared to China at 37. So you have a very youthful, well-educated workforce. In Vietnam, the average PISA score is 502. So PISA is an assessment of math, reading, and science competencies of 15-year-olds, and the study was done in 2015. So the Vietnam score of 502 compares to the US score of 488 and the score in UK of 500. So English ability is surprisingly good in young people in Vietnam. I think even better than Japan in my personal experience. If you just walk up to a random young person in a coffee shop in Vietnam, odds are you can carry a conversation in English. This makes Vietnam the new manufacturing center of the world, both at the low end, like textiles, and but also at the high end. Samsung has a $50 billion US dollars of export turnover in 2017, just from Vietnam, and they have also built a R&D center as well there. Inflation has been below 5% last year after a recent high, so it seems that the central bank has been successful in taming inflation and keeping interest rates steady. So the net result is that people in Vietnam are very optimistic about the future, and they're spending on investment, which is mostly housing, on education, and on consumer items as income levels rise and as the population moves into the middle class. Urbanization is also another trend as young people move into the major cities for jobs. So growth profile in Vietnam is very similar to what happened to China in the early 1990s. But the Vietnam government have also learned from China's experience and hopefully avoid some of the mistakes that they made. So right now they're restructuring a lot of the SOEs or state operated enterprises to increase privatization and to reduce the debt burden and the proportion of the SOEs in the economy. There's relaxation of foreign ownership limits in non-strategic sectors. They're improving the banking regulatory framework. They are implementing visa exemptions for foreign visitors to help spur tourism and investment. And there are a lot of free trade agreements that signed right now with ASEAN and Europe. And there's, compared to China, there's a lot less control of the internet. You're able to use Facebook and Google in Vietnam, and hopefully that should lead to greater innovation. And in the context of fairly steady GDP growth over the last decade, we're looking at a stock market that is still recovering from a debt-fueled bubble in 2007, 2008. And that bubble actually involved mostly real estate, but it also affected the stock market as well. So right now, the Vietnamese market, at first glance, is not cheap with a PE of around 18. But the index is really distorted by a few very large cap companies with really high PE ratios. Even then, I think the Vietnamese market right now is still cheaper than other growth markets in Asia, such as Philippines or Indonesia, with PEs at around 22. So without these four on their favorite companies that are in the ETFs, such as Finamilk, the Vietnam market has a PE of around 15. It was actually below 10 when I started investing a few years ago. If you look at the mid-cap index in Vietnam right now, it's around 11 times earnings, and small caps around 8 times. So there's still plenty of value to be found. So, So the company I would like to talk about today is Saigon Cargo Services, SCS. It has a market cap of about $250 million US, net cash position, $36 million, hardly any debt on the balance sheet. It is one of the two air cargo terminal operators located at the main airport in Ho Chi Minh City, and has right now 33% market share of all cargo throughput. They also leased apron space, offices, and even soccer fields on the same plot of land that they have. That's in the context of Vietnam's air flight industry, which is expected to grow at a rate of about 15.5% over the next 15 years. So pardon the pun, but this company has a long runway for growth. So let's look at the source of competitive advantage for SCS. So this is a picture of Ho Chi Minh City, or Saigon, as the locals like to call it. The airport, as you can see, is right in the middle of the city. And it was actually originally built to supply Saigon during the Vietnam War. So not much thought was put on the potential growth of air traffic and city planning when the airport was built. The great thing about this location is that you're only about 30 minutes from the commercial core of the city, District 1, which is at the bend of the Saigon River on the lower right of the map. It's extremely convenient, but there's really no space. So zooming in closer, we see where SCS is compared to its main competitor, Tansonet Cargo Services. So TSN Cargo Services is currently operating at full capacity. As you can see, they simply have no more land to expand, and all incremental cargo traffic is now flowing to SCS. There are plans for airport expansion, but that's for a passenger terminal only and not for cargo. So we find ourselves in a duopoly, in a situation where most of the capex for the cargo terminal has already been laid out. So all incremental revenue from higher cargo traffic will pretty much flow directly to the bottom line. Right now, they're running at about 70% of phase one capacity, which is 200,000 tons a year. And they can easily increase capacity to a maximum of 350,000 tons a year with fairly minimal capex. So we're looking at maybe around 7 to 10 million US of capex over the next 7 years to fund that expansion. The original investment made in this company was only about 50 million US 10 years ago. So the compared to the market cap right now of about 200 million US, the value that has been generated has been quite phenomenal and can be attributed to this moat. So having a structural moat around the business is definitely important. So the next thing I look for is honest and able management. So the major shareholders in SCS is the Air Force, which provides the land for the terminal, and the Airport Corporation of Vietnam, which holds about a 16% share. So they will help SCS with securing licenses and with daily operations, and a logistics company called Gemadep, which supports SCS with logistics expertise. The current CEO actually came from Gemadep, and he has been there at SCS since the beginning. The operations guy had about 20 years of experience with Lufthansa Cargo. So when I visited the company, the operations excellence was very evident. The concept design for the terminal was done by Lufthansa Consulting Group, and the construction design was done by Japan Airport, who also designed the airport as well. They used the Hermes systems for cargo tracking, which is the gold standard in the industry. And the CEO has really built a culture of transparency and professionalism. It's very rare for a Vietnamese company that you can actually track their activity record on their website. So if you go onto the SCS website, you can actually track how much cargo they're moving every month, and that is their main revenue driver. So looking at the financial performance, The thing that jumped out at me when looking at the P&L was the cash generating ability of the company and the amount of operating leverage. So last year, they were able to expand revenue by 17%, but operating profits went up 32%, and they were able to achieve a return on asset of 36%. So this is a very capital light business that is highly profitable as a result of a high barrier to entry. Notice that maintenance CapEx is only around 3 billion dong a year. So pretty much all the cash flow goes to shareholders. And like I said before, you only need to spend about 35 billion dong a year in growth CapEx in order to get to that capacity level. Also note that there is a 30 billion dong a year preferred dividend payment that gets paid out to the Air Force, who owns the preferred shares, but they don't get paid the regular dividends. So looking at the valuation, revenue is expected to be 580 billion this year, and also to be able to compound that at 20% a year. So 15% of from traffic growth and about 3 to 5% price increase a year until capacity is reached sometime in 2023. And we can see EBIT margin currently at 66%, and it will be able to climb higher than 80% as the majority of costs are fixed. So right now the company is trading at about 19 times current earnings and 17 times 2018 earnings. So I think that's a fairly reasonable price for a cash cow that is earning 40% return on equity. You can also do a DCF valuation, which I've done here, and model out the cash flow until the airport reached capacity in 2022. And what I did was put in a conservative 3% terminal growth rate after that and using a 12% cost of equity. So there is about a 15% upside compared to the current price of 117,000 dong. But this analysis is only based on the current visible revenue stream. The interesting part comes from the many optionalities that is embedded in the business. So the company right now pays out about 70% of its operating cash flow as dividend, and you get a yield of around 5%. But there are many ways that the company can add to its revenue stream. For example, management plans to build a new office building right now where the soccer fields are, and has the potential for generating about 72 billion in rental income a year. And it will only cost them about 200 billion to build the building. And so we're looking at a 3-year payback period with the ability to raise rents later. They are also in discussion with joint venture partners right now to start a catering operation to compete against Vietnam Airlines, who is currently the only player at that airport right now. And in speaking to management, they have told me that they will not be putting up any cash in any type of joint venture agreements. Instead, they'll lend out the space and they'll just take part of the profits that will come in from the joint venture. So that, I think, is a very smart move. Management are also always looking for ways to increase income from the current space that they have. For example, they are right now working on adding a floor above the current technical building for an extra 600 square meters of space, and it'll just cost them $250,000. And also keep in mind that the capacity I said earlier of 350,000 tons is based on the current warehouse configuration and technology. You can increase capacity many ways, for example, by adapting new technology such as radio frequency tags. The current system is based on barcodes, and capacity is really a function of throughput. So any ways that you can increase the speed of the cargo moving through the facility, you can increase the capacity. There's also the possibility of tweaking the design of the facility and to make better use of the excess apron space and increase the turnover of aircraft, etc. So there are many, many ways for the companies to look at increasing revenue. I think the most interesting thing about this company and the biggest source of uncertainty comes in the plan to build a new international airport in a Bontang, which is 40 kilometers east of Ho Chi Minh City, and it's expected to be operational in 2025. So the airport at Tan Son Nhat right now is running at 140% passenger capacity. So basically, there is a really urgent need for a new airport. Even if the expansion at the current site will be limited given the land constraints. So the biggest risk that a lot of people see is that, well, will SCS get a seat at the table at the new airport? And I think that because there's high ownership by the military and the Airport Corporation of Vietnam, I really think that SCS will most likely be allocated space at the new airport. I mean, they're a proven operator with international accreditations, and it is likely that both airports will remain in operation, and the new airport will provide even greater volume to the company. And even after the new airport is built, SCS will remain in control of pretty much what is a prime piece of real estate at the old airports. If we look at the future demand of air cargo traffic in Vietnam, we expect an acceleration of growth to 15% from the current, about 13% from 2020 on, as new capacity comes online. So even if there's an entry of new players at the new Long Thanh Airport, there's still plenty of air cargo to move. So the current air cargo volume activity, it's really safe, I would say, for at least the next 12 years. The transporting cargo through Tan Son Nhat Airport is a lot cheaper because of the proximity to Ho Chi Minh City. Tan Son Nhat Airport can facilitate all large aircraft types, and the phase one capacity of the new airport is only expected to be 1.2 million tons. And the total demand for that time for air cargo throughput in South Vietnam will be around 2 million tons. So at the end of phase one, we're looking at 2030 here. So there really is not enough new capacity to shut down the old airport. So perhaps a major downside of a possible expansion will be the CapEx spend for new equipment and building at Long Thanh. But I think that the cash generation of the company will be definitely be up to task. Remember, the original investment for the current site was only $50 million US, and the company is worth five times that in less than 10 years. Now, of course, investing in frontier markets, there are risks unique to Vietnam. So first and foremost, there's a lack of transparency and I guess Western style due process around decisions that's made regarding infrastructure development. There's a lot of transparency at the company level, but more on a national planning level, it's really, they decide what's going on and then they'll just announce it and execute it. But we do know that what the general direction that the government wants to take, and that is to reduce air traffic congestion in Ho Chi Minh City, and they want to support the export sector. The government and the airport authority own large stakes in SCS, and it's really in their interest that the company does well. So I guess the positive side is that things can get done very quickly in this kind of environment. One other risk that you have to watch out for is that the currency, the Viet Dong, has historically been fairly volatile, and it's also fairly heavily influenced by the renminbi. If you remember the renminbi devaluation last year, Vietnam was also forced to follow that devaluation because they compete for a lot of the export volume as well with China. But right now, strong exports and remittances have really helped increase the supply of foreign currency to Vietnam. And actually, the Viet Dong was the most stable currency in Asia this year. And being a major exporting country, Vietnam is fairly susceptible to a global recession. So there's a large decrease in demand for goods. It will hurt Vietnam as well. And finally, for a lot of companies, SCS included, English financial statements are not yet available. So you really have to rely on brokers to provide you with financials, and you might have to do Google Translate for announcements. For SCS, the management speaks very good English and is very open to investors, but the company, the country of Vietnam is still at the very beginning stages of opening up to foreign investors. So I don't really recommend anybody investing in SES or in Vietnam without actually visiting the country and speaking with the companies and the people in the industry to really know what you're getting into. And one good way to learn is to partner with specialist Vietnam funds that have a good track record and with good local players on the ground. And if you're interested, you can always contact me after and we can talk offline. So in summary, SES is a very strong moat company trading for 5x peak cash flow when they reach capacity in 2023. It has no debt, very intelligent capital allocation by an open and able management team. And there are very various optionalities embedded in the company that can enhance value, such as new building, operations at the new airport, catering operation, and expanding capacity. And best of all, it's a very transparent business with a high margin of safety that's in a fast-growing economy. And I would say that the best way to monitor the company would be simply watch the cash. The dividend payout is real, and the company reports monthly operational numbers. So it's very easy to model what the company is doing. So it's an investment that's easy to monitor in a very attractive area of the world. And that concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, I'm happy to entertain. Thank you so much.
Clement, thank you. That was a wonderful doubleheader. It's great to learn more about Vietnam, and the idea you shared was also very eye-opening and fascinating. I'd love to please go back to slide number 5, the Why Vietnam slide. This is a very, very interesting visual. I'm curious to understand any resources, books, videos, mental models you have found that help you understand this dynamic with the bigger picture?
A lot of it for me was just personal experience. Growing up in Hong Kong and seeing the place transform from the paddy fields in new territories, and in the span of 20 years, we have industrial buildings pop up, and 20 years after that, it's become the world's financial center. So I lived through that experience. In terms of reading, I think eight books by Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore will help illustrate a lot of his thinking in terms of building the foundation for that type of economic growth in his country at that time. And a lot of parallels can be drawn to other tiger economies, and definitely what I'm seeing right now in Vietnam.
And jumping to slide number 7, my understanding is that Bangladesh has very specific local tax withholding nuances, and India is rather difficult to access without being a local citizen. Are there any wrinkles to Vietnam that make it different or unusual in terms of access or in terms of the way the equity markets function locally?
I found that opening up an account in Vietnam is fairly straightforward. There is no tax for foreigners, that's not charged to locals as well. But for a lot of companies, there's a limit on foreign ownership. And once that's reached, you just simply cannot buy another share unless you buy from a foreigner, and often that is at a premium. That is something that the government and regulators are working on right now, and hopefully that limit can be lifted as we go forward. But there's no special tax like in Bangladesh or in India.
So it sounds very clearly like you went to Vietnam personally and you handled the documentation face to face. Is that?
Yes. Yes. That you will have to do that personally. Yes.
And if I could ask you, are you comfortable offline on a private basis sharing details of which brokers you trust with anyone who has further questions?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So please contact me by email and I'm happy to chat.
And moving to slide number 8, this is a very interesting data point, which I haven't seen before. I'm curious, the data source, I'm noticing a website on the right side, and there's also the Pew Global Study. Where does this come from, and how do you find this?
It's a survey that's done people just simply asking them what their expectations are going forward. So I've actually found this in an article about Vietnam, and I actually find the same sentiment just simply talking to people in coffee shops and even young people who might not even graduate with university degrees. They are all very entrepreneurial. Everybody is interested in starting a new business and trying new things, moving to the city. And that sort of atmosphere, I don't find as much in the West, in Canada or in the US. So it's something that I want to put up there. I think it's a sign of the underlying economic environment that's simply ripe for wealth creation and innovation.
And jumping to slide number 13, the strong management and ownership. Looking at the major shareholders, it might be possible that there are multiple objectives beyond return on capital and shareholder value creation. How do you think through the risk or the nuance of multiple objectives among major shareholders?
Well, I think what the government and the airport authority mostly want, aside from the very good dividend stream, is an operation that is very efficient and can help support Vietnam's growth as an export powerhouse. So you really want to just go into the incentive of the different players and see, you know, what sort of outcome they want. And as long as the incentives are aligned with you as a shareholder, I think you will have the potential to do well.
I'd like to please move forward to slide number 14. If anyone's trying to take a very long-term history review, how far back the financials go? How much data exists?
The company started 10 years ago, so it goes back 10 years.
And that is available if you start doing local financial searching?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's all on the website as well. So there's a fairly high degree of transparency here. The only downside is that the financials will be in Vietnamese, so you will have to find a translator. A shortcut is you can ask a broker to send you the financials in English. But you can find the source documents very easily on the web.
And I am noticing one peculiarity. I'm seeing the gross margins, I believe, are 78% in 2017. And I'm seeing that the EBITDA margin was 75.2%, I believe, as well. Does that basically mean there's 3% of middle line costs? Could that be possible? And it seems to be similar the year before. How is the operation so remarkably lean? It's shocking.
Most of the costs are fixed. So the machinery to do the x-ray, the forklifts, and there's very little that they have to add in terms to in order to handle higher volume. So they have huge operational leverage there. That's the reason why the margins can increase at such a high pace. And there's such a little difference between the EBITDA and the gross margins. There's very little depreciation as well. You can use the forklifts for 20 years, 30 years, even though they might be on the books for 10 years.
And just out of sheer curiosity, are there any non-Vietnamese companies that are public which do similar operations, just have a common sense comparison of everything?
Yeah, there are several air logistics companies that are listed around the world. I was a little reluctant to put them on the slides because they all have really different characteristics. So one that's listed in the US, for example, is Atlas Air World. They are a lot more heavily indebted. So they have a debt equity ratio of over 100% and earning very low ROEs. And they trade around 20 times, but the characteristics of each operator is very different. So it's never an apples to apples comparison. Here with SES, you have a duopoly operator, with high throughput growth that you can very clearly see. With the other companies, they might be one of many operators and they have to fight for traffic with price. So the dynamics are very different, and I wouldn't want to make direct comparisons that way.
And moving forward to slide 15, this is a very, I guess, high-class problem to have, but this seems to have the possible DNA of a long-term compounder in theory, and that requires a long-term time horizon. I'd like to understand if there are any benefits to being public and any benefits to being a standalone company. How do we not worry about this company being acquired or somehow choosing not to be public?
Well, I think that the Vietnamese government made a very good decision in making this company public because it really opens up the company to public scrutiny and you're now responsible for having a high level of transparency, so you can see the throughput that's going through the company, going through the operation center every single month. You can see where your cash is going, and the public can also participate in the growth as well of the company. So that's the idea behind privatizing these state assets. Otherwise, you know, they could they will be owned by the government, and you know, they might overcharge. A lot of the money will go to the insiders, and that is not the way to create an efficient society.
Moving to slide 17, I think you actually answered the question already, but I was going to ask, does the shareholder base create the reason for a 70% payout ratio? I guess the answer is yes. Is that a correct assumption?
Yes, and right now they actually don't really have like a distinct target for using the cash. So right now they're happy to just pay out most of the cash to the shareholders until there's a definite plan, say, for example, in terms of building up the new airport and what their investment have to be there. In that case, management will reconsider that 70% payout ratio. And it seems to me that based on the history of what the company has done with success cash flow and the way it's looking at potential investments, I think that they are fairly shareholder friendly in terms of thinking about deploying cash flow only in situations where they can earn a high return on investment.
And moving one slide forward to the risks, please. Which would you say is most on your mind?
I would say that the biggest unknown for this company would be what happens with the new airports. So the biggest risk for me would be waking up one day and learning that SES don't have a slot at the new airport. I think the likelihood of that is very small, but it exists. And that's why I think there's an opportunity to buy the stock cheaply right now.
And moving forward, two slides to the frontier market risks. This yes. might be the fulcrum of the presentation that people have to get their head around, the Vietnam factor. Can you speak a bit more about how you think through the Vietnam level risk factors?
So I was actually working at a hedge fund before I started Lion Rock Funds. And one of my focus was looking at shorting fraudulent Chinese companies that list in North America. So with markets that we're generally not very familiar with, there are several common characteristics when it comes to frauds in that area. So they're generally brought to these fraudulent companies are generally brought to market by the same player. So John Hampton, for example, keeps a list of all the shady characters to get ideas for his shorts. And they also appeal to a non-local investor base. So always interests me why companies will go all the way overseas for capital and local. You know, if you talk to them, they don't really know the company, and they have assets and revenue that's very hard to track. So for example, if you look at Sino Forest, they can take you to a forest in the middle of nowhere, and you wouldn't have any idea whether it really belongs to them or not. So for me, the way I look at it is like trying to find a good restaurant in a foreign city. And you can go to a place with signs and menus in English, and they offer pizza, you know, just outside of a major attraction, or you can ask a local where they go for lunch or where they would like to take their mom for a nice dinner. And if you go the second route, I find that I hardly ever went wrong, and I never got food poisoning or had bad food in my travels. But if you do the first thing and just go into the tourist place, I can pretty much guarantee you will overpay and the food is not that good. So I think the same thing applies in frontier market and in Vietnam as well. You really have to think like a local investor and do your due diligence like a local investor. So making the trip to the country, talking to the people, and talking to the management is extremely important in this type of investing.
And if you can move forward to slide 22, the last slide with your contact information. This has been a real treat and also an honor to learn from you, and you've been very generous with your insights and your time. Please tell us what type of feedback you would most like to receive.
Oh, I'm happy to hear from any fellow investors who would like to learn a little bit more about Vietnam, or I would also like to know as well if you have done any work on SCS or other companies in Vietnam and would like to share your ideas. I would love to hear different points of view, so please tell me if you think I'm wrong, or even if you just won't have a restaurant ideas to share in Saigon. I'd love to know.
And you do find yourself in Toronto occasionally, is that correct?
Yes, so I spend half my time in Toronto and half my time in Hong Kong, which makes it easier for me to travel around Asia. And so if you're ever in town, please drop me a line, let me know, and yeah, we can go out for lunch.
On that note, thank you very much for being here with us at Best Ideas 2018 and sharing your unique domain expertise. This was very eye-opening. Hoping that the audience will indeed reach out. This has been a very educational and eye-opening experience. Thank you for being here. We hope to see you back. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shai. It's been a pleasure.